Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello and welcome to episode 129 of the world's first Paul Weller fan podcast. I'm Dan Jennings, and 10 years ago, I gave up my live streaming career as a radio presenter with one big regret. Never getting to interview my hero, the legendary singer-songwriter and musician, Paul Weller. This podcast exists purely to solve that issue. Welcome to Desperately Seeking Paul. On this episode of the podcast, I am joined by another legend in the industry. Virginia Turbutt is my very special guest, a British rock music and social reportage photographer known for her shots of bands, fans and street culture. We're talking Sounds magazine, smash hits, The Face, ID. Her first photo assignment was the Sex Pistols shooting on their Pretty Vacant video. She captured all the scenes, music, the fans, the fashion, punk, heavy metal, mod, new romantic, reggae, two-tone and electro pop. She's traveled all around the world capturing bands and solo artists, including The Jam, The Clash, Blondie, Iggy Pop, Prince, U2, Andy Warhol, Frank Zappa, Nick Cave, Depeche Mode, Madness and David Bowie. This is another very special guest on the podcast. Let's get into it. Virginia Turbutt, thanks for joining me.
It's a pleasure, Dan. Thank you for having me.
Now, I'm really looking forward to chatting with you because there's so much of your life has been this love of music, this love of photography. But to kick things off, I'd love to know what came first. Was it the music or was it the love of the visuals, the image?
Definitely the music. I became a fan, and that's where it all came out of me being a fan. So I became a fan when I was 9, 10. The Monkees were my first loves, and I remember they played 3 nights at Wembley Stadium or Wembley Arena, and I cried every night because they were there and I wasn't. And my mum wouldn't let me go.
Oh no.
So I loved Davy Jones the best, which was a really poor choice, but you know, typical. My sister had more taste. She went for Peter Tork, who was much more interesting. Yeah, and I do have a Peter Tork story.
Oh, brilliant. You'll have to tell me that in a second. But I love the fact that, because the Monkees, like proper manufactured band, manufactured for the TV show.
Right? I think the first time that happened, I think. Yeah, because they were auditioned like they do these days. Yeah, for the TV show. And you know, there were some great musicians in them. I did make the mistake, having never seen the Monkees and it always being this trauma for me, obviously. I did make the mistake of going to see them in Plymouth, which is near me, about 20 years ago, something like that. And I walked out after 4 songs.
Oh, no. Why?
Because it was just so sad. There were these old blokes. And the worst thing they did was there was all these old blokes on the stage surrounded by younger musicians who were propping them up. But behind them, they had footage of The Monkees, the TV show, running all the time. So there was no getting away from the fact that they were beautiful young men and here all these doddery old blokes. It was just really sad. So
interestingly, Mr. Weller wrote with Noel Gallagher, wrote a song for their final album. So
did
there
you
is
hear
a
me?
Yeah.
Oh my God, now my interest is peaked. Okay, I shall have to check that
yeah,
out.
Birth of an Accidental Pop Star, I think it was called, if I remember rightly. But yeah.
Wow.
So what was the story? What were you going to say?
Oh, the Peter Talk story. Yeah. So some years later, I think it's about 1981. So obviously I was a grown up by then. And I was in a club called Hurrahs in New York. And I was staying with a friend who worked at Sire Records. And she was great. She introduced me to loads of people. She was standing in this club. And she suddenly turns around and says, oh, Virginia, I want you to meet my friend, Peter Talk. And I'd had lunch with Frank Zappa that day.
As you do.
But this... wow. I just turned into this 10-year-old girl again and lost all my cool. And, oh my God, Peter Talk. Oh my God. And he said, how lovely to meet you, Virginia. And I just thought, I can't remember nothing much, you know, like that was the end of it.
I love that though. That kind of instant you're back there. You're that 10-year-old crying into your pillow.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just, you know, I always say that it was one of, you know, like I was in a room with Andy Warhol and spoke with him, but actually meeting Peter Talk was so exciting because it went back to exactly that. It went back to where I come from being a fan and loving, you know, these bands being integral to my growing up. I had a friend who was very much older than me, so I was sort of aware of a lot of them, bands like Jefferson Airplane and The Doors. And then in 1972, was introduced to David Bowie. And of course, you know, then there's a very familiar story of, you know, David Bowie changed my life. And
well, it was Hunky Dory that started that, wasn't it? Was that right? Somebody gave you a cassette.
It was very good. Yeah, Hunky Dory. So I was in Cornwall and met some guys from Bristol and they were camping on this cliff top where my family and I were in a caravan park and it was very wet and we were in the tent and they had a big cassette player. And they put on Hunky Dory and they knew all about this guy. And that was it. I went home and I ordered the entire back catalogue, which was Man Who Sold the World, Space Oddity, and then waited for Ziggy Stardust to come out, ordered that in advance. And, you know, the rest is history because Bowie was, you know, like lots of people say, who would I be if I hadn't had Bowie? And
yeah, incredible. I mean, absolutely incredible legacy and back catalogue. Bar maybe the Tin Machine stuff, that never did it for me, but a lot of the stuff.
No,
I loved all
and
the...
I agree. There was I have a period when I wasn't interested really. You know, the early stuff was definitely formative. And there is, you know, but who would I have been if I hadn't been sort of, and then Bowie introduced us all to Lou Reed and Iggy Pop and the Velvet Underground and all that. So I was, you know, I was really into gigs and, I was, spending all the money that I earned babysitting, buying tickets, loads of tickets so that all my mates could go. And I don't think anyone ever paid me back. I was always the one who sort of traveled to Portsmouth or London and called Guildford and queue up to get the tickets and then make sure we got a driver. So I had to give the driver a ticket and give someone else to sit with. I don't know. It's like... So it was me getting the tickets.
But it was such a social aspect of it, like you and your mates in it together, right?
Yeah. It was, you know, I'd have to get a driver and then, usually, I think I always bought four tickets, so there'd be two other people. And it was great. I mean, you know, we went up and down the A3 to gigs all the time for my school years. And, of course, Bowie was in that. So, you know, that's where it came from. It came from being a fan. You know, I loved going to gigs. I loved, you know, when it was the Monkees, I was buying Fab 208 and... when I, then after that was NME. So Thursday mornings, the NME, you know, excitement, get off the bus, go straight into the newsagent, buy the NME. That was my Bible. Check out who was playing where. Yeah.
It's weird, isn't it? Because how we consume our news about artists and how we discover new music is so different and plus and actually challenging as well, I think, because you're kind of served algorithms on Spotify and all that, but you don't get to read those interviews and find that information out about new bands in the way that you did, do you?
No, I mean, it was religious, you know. I remember I say it was my Bible. You know, I'm not kidding. I just absorbed everything in it. The journalists became kind of like my friends, you know. I love, you know, people who I love, like Charles Sean Murray. I just thought, my God, you know, he's got access to all these people. He's got a sense of humor and some I like more than others. But yeah, they became part of the sort of the family. Waited every week to see where they'd been and who they'd been talking to. And
well, amazing that some, you know, fairly soon after, you're taking photos for the some of those publications that we talk about, like Sound, Smash Hits and that. So let's link the journey then from this love of music to taking photos. Was this just an amateur thing where you take photos at gigs initially, or how did that come about?
No one took photos at gigs then, really. I mean, very rarely. No, it was just an accident. So I had no ideas about being a photographer or anything like that. I didn't have any ideas about what I was going to do much. My boyfriend at the time, so this is 1977. There is a picture that I took at a gig, and it must be 1973 or 4, I think. It's Lou Reed at Crystal Palace garden party they used to have, and there's the Crystal Palace Bowl, and there's a lake in front of it. And I waded into the lake up to about here in mud and with a little Instamatic camera. And I have these pictures of Lou Reed on the stage with these other wet people standing in front of me. I don't know. I mean, I didn't have a change of clothes or anything. It was really deep, really wet. And then the rain came down. James Taylor came on stage and there was this whole fire and rain thing, and the lightning came and he had to run off stage. And by which time, you know, I was just soaked. And somehow I got in the car and drove all the way back to West Sussex. I didn't drive, I was driven. And I remember my mum the next day saying, "How did this, your clothes, how did you get so much?" What? She said, "I put them through like 4 washes." And I said, "Oh, I walked through a puddle." I don't know. Anyway, so that was the first thing I ever photographed. And I've got this picture in my, it's this tiny little picture and it's so faded, but it's on a montage that I've made years and years ago in my bedroom. And that's my first ever music picture. So then after that, it was 1977, and my boyfriend at the time had been to art school and knew other art school people. He had a camera. A friend of ours had been to America and was involved in starting Slash magazine there. And he came back and was sort of the UK correspondent for Slash magazine and asked me if I'd like to go along with him to interview a couple of bands and take the pictures, and he'd do the interview. And the first one was the Sex Pistols in June 1977, when they were recording Pretty Vacant. So that's my first session.
That's your first gig. I love it. The first photography gig, the Sex Pistols. Oh, huge. And let's talk about that explosion of punk, because so many of your photos that people will know and love from that period are with those bands, you know, of that time as well. And it was huge, wasn't it? And that kind of, you know, people have talked on the podcast about this being music for them as youngsters. Suddenly you had your own thing. But take us back there, if you would, Virginia. What, you know, what was it like being part of that scene?
I can't say I was really part of the scene. I mean, I was living in Guildford at the time, and I was aware, though, of this stuff going. You know, I wasn't like going to the clubs every weekend or anything like that. But what I became aware of very quickly was that it became accessible, because growing up through the 70s, and, you know, rock had become this enormous, enormous machine, and it was huge bands and it was all very precious. And suddenly everyone was in a band and they were all practicing in their dad's garages. And not only were they forming bands and making fanzines, but they were gigging as well. So everything which had seemed like impossible, if you weren't Emerson, Lake and Palmer or Pink Floyd or some other god awful, boring, you know, these things became possible. And that was so exciting. And it revealed so much talent and genius. You know, on every cul-de-sac, in every street, there were these kids who were getting together and going, "I can do that." Buying a guitar, coming together, you know, just that "I can do that" attitude. You know, you don't have to be signed, you don't have to be on a big label, you don't have to have a manager, you don't have to, you know. And then there was Rough Trade and John Peel and everything, and people would take their cassettes up to John Peel and stand in the foyer, and I'd done that, and, you know, sitting on the session, on the shows with him, and everything was available to create. And it was extraordinary. And the same with the photography. I mean, nowadays, I mean, every now and again, people get in touch and say, you know, "What do I need to do? How do I get into this?" And I think, well, go back to the 1970s, to late 1970s, and you might stand a chance, but I have no idea now. But you know, there were fanzines, so people were printing and writing and taking their photographs and publishing them. People like me, who with no experience whatsoever, I had to, in the middle of my Sex Pistols session, I had to go to a camera shop in Tottenham Court Road and ask them to change the film for me. People like me were getting their work published. And then there was this sort of serendipitous couple of events which led to me starting photography as a sort of job and at the same time having my work published in a major music magazine.
And this then takes you around the world. So we're talking about, you know, all over Europe, all the USA, and these huge artists, people like The Clash and Blondie. You mentioned Frank Zappa earlier on, like Iggy Pop, you mentioned, like massive, massive stars and musicians, but they were all kind of starting out the early days and then becoming huge successes. It took off quite quickly in terms of your career and the success of it, I would guess.
Yeah, I did suddenly find myself right in the midst of it, really. So I'd met Gary Bushell, who had just started on Sounds in 1978. I went on a political march called the Right to Work March in September 1978. And Gary Bushell came from that background and he was on the march and I met him there. He just started on Sounds and he asked me if I'd like to take pictures with him on Sounds. And he was covering all these new bands that were emerging, as I said, from these, you know, little towns and villages all over the country. So as I was learning photography, I was getting my work published. Then there were sort of bigger bands. I mean, The Clash, you know, were not big at that time. They weren't, you know, The Clash lived around the corner from me. I'd see them every time I walked out and went to the supermarket. But yeah, it was strange. And meeting, you know, people like Frank Zappa and people who I'd, Iggy Pop, who I'd never imagined being in a room with, you know.
So. Now let's talk about Mr. Weller. So the first time you saw The Jam play live, I think I'm right in saying 1979 Sheffield University.
You're absolutely right, yes.
Well, am I right in thinking you were recently scanning some photos and found a bunch of stuff from that session or from that gig?
Yes. I was scanning stuff yesterday. I'm always looking for stuff actually that I haven't seen before. Yeah. I'm always going through it and seeing what I've missed before.
What can you remember about that gig?
Well, I remember things like it was one of the first big gigs I did. And I got picked up. I was living in Dalston at the time on Sandringham Road, which at that time was really poor. It was all rented housing and sweatshops and everything. And a limo came to pick me up at about 6 o'clock in the morning to drive me. It was sent by Polydor Records to drive me to, I can't remember the name of the place, and where we would meet the Jam coach. So I went in a limo, Gary went in a limo, and we waited in this freezing cold for the Jam coach to turn up. And then we got on the Jam coach and went up to Sheffield. So it was my first time in a limo for a song. And we were going up, we were driving into Sheffield in the coach. We were talking, chatting with Paul and that on the coach. And there were these kids, sort of parkers and stuff, walking over the bridge. I think it was a bridge. And they were eating chips. And Paul stopped the coach and he went down to the door and he waved them to. He said, come on, come on the coach. And these kids just chucked their chips over the bridge. His hard-earned chips. And they just chucked them over and got on the coach. And there they were on the coach with Weller. I always say, tell that story because the one thing about the Jam, which I really noticed because I came from being a fan, I was always really interested in the fans and I took a lot of photographs of people and fans. In fact, I've just this morning been collecting New Romantics punks and mods for 3 publications. And I have a lot of pictures of the fans because I, you know, they're integral. Without the fans, none of this means anything. And I really noticed very quickly how the Jam took care of their fans. They looked after them. They let them into all of the sound checks. They would all be standing outside. They knew they could get in. John would let people in the back. And it was just so refreshing and nice to see that from a band who were reasonably big.
Yeah, can you imagine? Like, yeah, I've said this point. You know, Ed Sheeran letting everybody in for the soundtrack or stuff. It just doesn't happen,
does
it?
Stopping
the bus, the tour bus, so get rid of your chips, get on board. Yeah, it doesn't happen.
And the fans all loved that. You know, the fans felt part of the Jam family. That, you know, with John and Anne and Jill at that time, and you know, they felt that. The community, they felt part of the Jam community. And I think that was really extraordinary. And I say that if there was a time machine, there are 2 gigs I would go back to. And one is, I was fortunate, lucky, because I queued up for the tickets, to be at Bowie's last Ziggy gig at Hammersmith Odeon on July the 3rd, 73. So I would go back to a Bowie Ziggy Stardust.
Was that was the night he killed off Ziggy? Was
it? It was the night he said it's the last, not only is it the last night of the tour, but it's the last and I was one of those wailing women. But the other gig I would go to would be the jam, any jam gig, really. But that last night in Brighton, which I didn't take photos at, I just loved it, every minute of it.
What was it about that band live then that was so different, so special for you?
The first thing that comes to mind is that everyone sang every word to every song at a jam gig. And I love that. I absolutely love that. Participation, audience participation, you know. That was what was so refreshing about the whole punk thing. You know, we'd grown up with, because we all come from somewhere and there was this music before punk. It involved sitting down, often cross-legged on a floor. And, you know, you weren't supposed to do anything except kind of enjoy the vibes. But that whole participation, whether that's kind of down the front, mashing and, you know, was shaking and,
you can't see the actions here, podcast listeners, but Virginia's back there. You're back in the front row.
Yeah,
you're
back in the mosh pit. I loved it down the front. I even loved to take pictures down the front. I would go in the pit, if there was a pit, which there wasn't always. If there wasn't a pit, I'd just happily go right down the front with all my cameras getting gobbed on. Right? That's the worst thing.
I remember seeing, during lockdown, actually, I remember seeing a post from you, I think it would have been on Instagram, where you said about, there were a couple of, you said, here's a couple of pics to remind ourselves of what we miss when there's no live music and why down the front is the only place to be at a gig. Do you remember that?
It's got a good memory.
It is. I mean, that's always the bit I want to go. If I can get front barrier these days so I can hold on to something, so that always helps. Otherwise, my feet get very tired. But yeah, you've got to be in the front, right?
You've got to be down the front. Otherwise, you might as well be at home. You know, that's where it's all going on. And Yeah, I did also say then, didn't I? I didn't miss the gobbing, but...
Yeah. I've never understood that about that.
Let's move on, really. The jam wasn't the worst. The jam was not as bad as the called a Clash.
Really? Oh. Now, look, there are a few photos I want to talk about. So let's see if I can jog your memory. So there was the Rainbow Theatre. This was April 1980. There's a photo you've taken, Paul plugging his guitar in live on stage, which is like a really iconic shot. What do you remember about that?
The gig was, I like the Rainbow. It was a good venue. There was a lot of gigs going on there at the time. I remember, like, because he did that a lot. And I remember always, and I've got a lot of pictures where I didn't quite get it. And I think even that one, it's not totally sharp. They were just great to see live, great to photograph live.
There's another one in as well, which lots of ladies and men listening to this will love this shot. This is 1981, the Guildford Civic Hall, Mr. Weller, top off.
Oh, yeah. Well, yes. Well, one is that Guildford was my local venue. That's where I first saw Bowie in 1973, May the 27th. So that's the home turf for me. I remember I had friends who were outside. It was a really, really, really hot day. My sister and her boyfriend and some other people were outside waiting to get in for the sound check. And I've got pictures of them in doing the sound check. It was really hot. And Bruce is wearing the shortest shorts like people used to in the 70s. And yeah, during the gig, Weller took his top off. Yeah. And he did remember the Plasmatics, Wendy O. Williams, she did the black tape on her nipples and Weller came out. Obviously, he thought about this in advance because I can't remember if he came out with his top on or he just took his top off and there was his nipples black taped as in Wendy O. Williams.
Brilliant. That's so good. And it's a great shot because he's like surrounded by it. There's the Vox amplifier down below and then there's this big Marshall stack as well. It's a brilliant shot, isn't it? Yeah, it's really cool. And I read somewhere that around that time, taking a bit of a detour away from Mr. Weller, that you saw Prince and you photographed him in Amsterdam as well.
I did, yeah. Without looking at my list, I couldn't tell you what the date was. But yeah, about that time, yeah. I didn't know anything about Prince, actually. I mean, I did often find myself photographing people who I knew absolutely nothing about. Sadly. And Prince hadn't got on my radar at all at that point.
That was really early days for him, wasn't it? I mean, that was pre-Purple Rain, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, it was. Yeah. Yes. I mean, he played
Was it Paradiso?
Paradiso, very famous club, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's not a big place. And I just remember thinking, if I'd seen Hendrix, you know, would I think this is like Hendrix? Because he was extraordinary, and I'd never seen anybody, sounds really kind of cliche, but kind of be as one with their guitar on the stage. And I've seen a lot of guitarists, but seeing Prince was something different. And it did bring to mind Hendrix, that whole thing of, you know, the guitar kind of appearing to be an extension of your body. And I know I really noticed that about Prince. And I photographed him live on stage and then backstage a bit. And those photos have been used a lot. And then we went back to, so it was with Tony Mitchell from Sounds and interviewed him in his hotel room. So I'm sitting on a bed with Prince in his hotel room, where he didn't want me to photograph him in there. And I seen him on stage, and it's this like powerful, extraordinary figure that was just emanating so much, I was going to say soul, but, you know, just so much power. And then this little tiny person comes into the room. He's got a really little tiny voice. and that was Prince.
That's brilliant, isn't it? The kind of flip side of the artist on stage and where that comes from. And actually, Anne Weller, when I had her, Paul's mum, on the podcast, she was saying about Paul as that.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
As a youngster, she was like, he was such a shy little boy. The idea of him ever getting on stage and playing to crowds and stuff, just where did that come from? That wasn't him. And it seems like he's, even now, is like a little bit shy in kind of company like that. It's funny, isn't it? The kind of flip side of the artist. But I remember, again, when you shared on one of the photos, the Prince photos on Instagram, this could be a whole episode of a podcast, but you said, I often wonder what sort of music the artists who died too soon will be making now. You know with certainty that Prince, Lennon, Bowie would still be knocking us sideways with their genius. I absolutely love that. But yeah, that's a huge debate, isn't it? But you're absolutely right. They'd still be knocking it out of the park, wouldn't they? I mean, Bowie's last couple of albums were sensational.
I know. Some people just had, I mean, Bowie definitely, and I think Lennon and Prince definitely, just had an ability to know what was coming. I mean, you know, some of the stuff Bowie said about the internet and it's extraordinary when you read back on that now. And Lennon always sort of kept with the times and moved forward. I couldn't say all his peers did. I mean, you know, of all of them, Lennon and Harrison, I guess, would be the ones I'd be interested in, those four. But yeah, it would be interesting. And, you know, Hendrix is another one, I guess. You know, what would he have been doing?
Absolutely. I want to ask you about studio time with Mr. Weller as well. So we talked about live music and the jam and that impact it had on you. But you spent time in the studio taking photos of Paul as well. And there's a wonderful story around Air Studios in 1982. And this story about Mr. Weller and Paul McCartney. Please tell me this. This is fabulous.
Well, this leads on from what I was just saying. So I'm in there waiting to photograph Weller for a Smash Hits feature. Paul McCartney comes in. This is in this sort of little side room. Paul McCartney comes in and Thatcher is on the telly and he does a Sieg Heil to Thatcher on the telly for a start, but I'm in the room with Paul McCartney and I've got all my cameras and I'm a rock photographer. And there is one of the Beatles, one of the most famous, recognisable people in the world in the 20th century. And do I take a photo of Paul McCartney? Didn't do it. Somebody else that day did take a photo, because they were exactly the same clothes, of Paul McCartney and Weller.
I was going to say, because Weller's obviously a massive Beatles head and McCartney's his favourite, and there's the opportunity, the two of them.
They weren't both together in the same room at the same time, but, you know, somebody else got that picture that day. I didn't even think about it, because what I did think was this wasn't long before the Frog Chorus.
Yeah.
And I just thought, I don't know, he was kind of being a bit of a tosser.
The Beatles hadn't had that kind of, what's that word, that reevaluation of them. They weren't cool. It wasn't cool to like the Beatles in the early 80s, was it really?
That's very kind of you. And that's a very kind, useful excuse that I shall always use from now on.
You're welcome.
I mean, the next time I sat in a room with Paul McCartney was actually at the preview for his Goodbye to What's It Street film that he made. It was in a cinema.
Oh, Give My Regards to Broad Street.
And the little film that accompanied that was the Frog Chorus film.
Oh, right.
And, you know, I just, there was no respect. There was, there we go. Missed opportunity.
That was my first Paul McCartney album, that album. And it's just packed full of, most of it, reversioning of Beatles songs, which I hadn't realised at the time. Yeah. Like Wanderlust. Oh, no, there's Wings, I think. Lots of stuff that's kind of basically just rehashing stuff. But I hadn't realised. I thought it was just a Paul McCartney album, really.
He'd done Wings, and I wasn't interested in Wings. I mean, Wings were just a pop band. So, yeah, I know. There we go.
And you were there for Smash Hits, and this was a series of photos that you took for something called Favourite Things. Was that right?
Yeah. I did a few series of Smash Hits of rock stars and their mums and rock stars and their cars, and one was rock stars and their favourite things.
And can you remember what Paul said in the article or what he picked?
I'd have to look at the picture. He had, was it a pair of sunglasses? Just trying to find the contact sheets. Here we go. Yeah, so what did he have? He's got, I'm just looking at the contact sheet. There's a jacket. It's in black and white, so it's a bit difficult. There's a jacket and three singles, and I can't actually make out the titles of them from the contact sheets.
Do you know what? One of the people listening, and I'll put this out on Twitter, we'll have a copy of that Smash Hit still saved. You know? We'll have to get it for the show notes. There was a photo with this is quite famous as well, the Weller Woking sweatshirt, which wasn't his, right? He didn't go around wearing that all the time.
He was wearing it.
Oh, did he came in wearing it, did he?
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Yeah. That was in the Stooges. That was in Polygram, I think. And hang on, there's the pictures of him with his. No, I didn't ask him to wear it.
I assume somebody had given it to him or something for a shoot. I didn't realise it was.
No, it wasn't that. Oh, here we go. There's more things. There's some cufflinks. Oh, he's wearing the jacket now. There's some cufflinks. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 singles and a box with something in it. Yeah, you can look up in the Smash Hits archives and find those. And he's wearing the Weller Woking shirt under the jacket in that. And then I got pictures of him just wearing the Weller Woking shirt.
And how did you find him in those kind of environments outside? Obviously, this is different to him live on stage. You're having to direct him more. You're having to kind of tell him what you want out of the shot more, right?
Yeah, I was never very good at that, actually. I was better with people who knew what they wanted to do. The kind of photography I really like is sort of more reportage stuff. I'm not good. I never did studio stuff because I didn't feel comfortable directing. And so I liked, you know, photographing people live, and lots of people like Madness knew exactly what they wanted to do all the time. But Paul was easy. Paul wasn't difficult. He was always very nice, very kind. And I mean, maybe I can't remember. Maybe I said, you know, just, oh, let's put you against that wall or something. But most of these people had a better idea of how they wanted to look in the photos anyway. If they didn't, then I'd manage.
Now, you mentioned the final Jam gig, which I know you didn't take photos of in Brighton, but you were there that final tour. There are photos. There's a brilliant photo of Paul with this. He's got this belt on which says Rubber Soul on it. This is Wembley. This is backstage Wembley Arena in December 1982. You took shots around that time of those final Jam dates as well.
Yeah, it was a sad thing. And Wembley was strange because, you know, it's such a big venue. Did they do two nights at Wembley?
I think they did more than that, yeah.
Three, was it three nights?
Yeah.
And I think that was the last night at Wembley. And people, you know, there were people from all over the world there. It was amazing. Paul was in a really good mood at Wembley. There was really a big, you know, backstage, there was Bruce and Rick were, you know, what the fuck are we going to do? You know, this is terrible. And Paul was in a, I've never seen Paul so happy as he was at Wembley. He was just, he was charming. He was lovely. He was bright. He was really, really smiling. He was obviously very excited about, you know, what he was going to do next. Whereas the atmosphere elsewhere in the room wasn't quite so positive. But Brighton was great. So I went down to Brighton and I didn't have a ticket, but like lots of other people just knocked on the back door and John let us in and then pushed my way right down the front and stood at the front singing every single song.
I love that. How did you feel about the Style Council? Were they, did they rock your world?
No. No, they didn't. I didn't sort of, I didn't pay them probably enough attention. I didn't pay them attention, really. I loved the Jam. I was, you know, I was definitely a Jam fan. I was interested in the Style Council, and I've always been, I just think Paul's a genius. He's an absolute genius. And I haven't followed what he's done, and I haven't bought everything or heard everything by any means. You know, when I hear his stuff and, you know, he's got a new album out and I hear bits off that, I'm always, 9 times out of 10, I think, God, you just keep on doing it. It's just, you're never going to lose it.
And still have a following as well. Still, because he's great. Oh, first and foremost, it seems he's creating that music for himself. But actually, he still has the people who want to follow him, and very Bowie-like in that sense, I think.
Yeah.
Just keep pushing forward, keep pushing the boundaries and stuff. And you have taken photos of Weller solo. I don't know, how early on did you get? Were you involved in the kind of, you know, in those early days, Wildwood, Stanley Road period, or did it come much later?
I remember going to see him in the studio with Mick Talbot, sort of not long after the Jam had finished. He wanted to see some contact shoots, and there was him and Mick in the studio, and they were, you know, obviously working on stuff for Style Council, and they were playing some stuff, and I remember thinking, well, this is going to be interesting. This is really different, but this is going to be interesting. And then I didn't see him for, because, I mean, what year was that? 1985, started having babies, since I had loads, but I had a baby in 1985, and I didn't photograph any gigs for a very long time. So it was years and years and years later, I got to see him in Plymouth, and he's one of the few people who comes down to the West Country. He always does Plymouth, and I respect him for that as well.
Yeah, well, my first gig was, I was living in Somerset and went to Paul Arts Centre, was my first Weller gig, 1992, I think. But you're right, he still does do the West Country and even play Cornwall summer before last, I think, right?
He does, and I've seen him in Cornwall as well, and most people don't. Yeah, that's really nice, and it's really appreciated, because usually we have to go to Bristol to see people, at least. So,
and the photos of Plymouth would have been, I think it was 2007. So this is pre 22 Dreams. It's the As Is Now period. So Steve White's still in the band. And it was the kind of final iteration of that band before Damon Minchella leaves, Steve White leaves, and they shake things up again, which he's constantly doing. So you did that tour. And then I think more recently you did The Kind Revolution as well. So you've taken shots of Paul live as a solo artist in that time too.
I have. I'm always going to be interested in what he does. You know, it's not going to be a Paul McCartney moment for me and Paul. No, I'm always interested. And yeah, I'm just having a look. The ones from Bristol, April 2017. Yeah, that's right. Kind Revolution ones. That's the last time I saw him, actually. Wow. About time I got to see him again.
It is about time, yeah. Well, he's still gigging, still touring, still really
music
and all that. It's incredible, really. But one of the interesting, obviously, we had this period of lockdown, which for lots of musicians, I mean, for everybody was bloody awful, but from photographers that I've spoken to, it seemed like it was also a period where you could go back into your archive and start kind of looking at stuff that you never got time to do, like cataloging it and all that. And it was really interesting talking to Dennis Munday on the podcast from his experience, because he was talking about just how crap record company and music magazine archives were, of like, because you, a lot of the time you were commissioned by them, so you were taking photos for them. They weren't necessarily your photos. They were, these kind of archives just don't exist, right? They didn't value these shots. And so a lot of your work you can't find. So a lot of your work's like the black and white stuff, but not the colour, right? Would that be right?
For me, I wasn't commissioned ever. So I owned all the pictures that I took. I bought the film. It is a thing. This comes up a lot these days, because we find our pictures being used all over the place. And especially, you know, when they read books, reproduce pages from the magazines and things. So copyright, you know, comes up as an issue. to. In fact, I was on something last week about this. For me, I own all the work that I took because I bought the film and I only got paid for whatever was published. So I could be away for 3 or 4 days. They might use only one picture. And I'd only get one payment for one picture. They might use 5 or 6 and I'd get paid for those. And then they'd get reused. I wasn't very savvy about the business. For me, I was just so grateful to be doing this. I was not savvy business-wise. You know, if I'm talking to my younger self now about how I was working then, I'd be absolutely horrified at what I let happen. Yeah, you're absolutely right about the archives. So there were huge archives of prints, handmade prints that we made in our darkrooms. And these have disappeared. They've completely vanished. For me, like, I've got more my black and white negatives, so I can scan those. And if I had a darkroom, which I haven't, I could print again. But my colour stuff, that was all originals that went to the music papers. And most of that has disappeared. And I had a conversation with Alan Lewis, who was the editor of Sounds. He was in Morgan Grampian. He was very influential and lots of people cite him as, having been significant in their careers. And he died a few years ago. But I spoke to him about 10 years ago and he said, it's absolutely criminal, how we treated people's photographs. They just went in the bin. People used to come in, fans used to come in and help themselves out of the archives. So you'd go to the Sex Pistols archives at Sounds, there'd be nothing in it. Absolutely nothing. Same as the Clash, nothing in it. Because the fans would come in, they'd get in through the doors and they'd come in. So we'd go and see Gary Bushell and they'd nip upstairs and help themselves. And the same with Smash Hits. I spent quite a long time trying to trace the Smash Hits archive, in which I have got thousands of handmade bromide black and white prints. I can't find it. No idea what happened to it. I've let it go now. So I do have some colour and the black and white stuff is mine. And that's my living. My archive is my living. And it's kind of feels very fortunate that I have this, really.
Well, and bloody fabulous it is too. There's one thing I wanted to ask you about. You mentioned Sounds again then and this kind of power of the music press. There was this wonderful front cover, which again, I think you shared recently on Instagram, which was March 1978. Let me take you back there. There was this cover where it said, "Is this the future of rock and roll? Racism in your music face to face with the front." And this was just a few weeks after the March to Victoria Park, which has come up on the podcast, this Rock Against Racism carnival rather. And this incredible cover for this music paper, which was essentially, it was, correct me if I'm wrong, it was photos of musicians who had been deported. So we had people like Ari Up from the Slits, Freddie Mercury was on full lineup, people like that, right?
I know the cover, right, so I'm looking at that now. And they're people who would be deported if the National Front got into power.
Oh, is that what it was? Right.
Yeah. So the National Front at that time were a genuine threat to British politics. And you had people like Eric Clapton, who came out and said how he supported Enoch Powell, who had made the Rivers of Blood speech. And it was a very, very frightening time. Yeah, the rhetoric is the same as it is now, basically, about invasion and the language that is used. It's incredible, really, that what short memories people have, that, we talk about the Holocaust in terms of, how could we have allowed this to happen? And yet people are still fleeing for their lives with nothing but the clothes they wear and their children and babies from situations where they will be, where they are in grave danger of being killed or tortured because of their ethnicity or their religion. So, I think this is still very relevant now. But it was hard hitting. And out of this, of course, came this out of this atmosphere of, we're not just going to stand back and let powerful, influential people like Eric Clapton take the youth along with them in this disgusting language. And Rock Against Racism was formed as a direct response to that, which was extraordinary. Rock Against Racism put on gigs and tours that went up and down the whole country, involved the most amazing lineups of musicians, the carnivals. There was the one you mentioned in 1978. I was actually in America when that happened, but I went to the second one in Brixton, and the tours they did, which ended up with a big gig at Alexandra Palace, and the marches and demonstrations, and kids really got behind that. It gave them something to rally behind that was, we're not going to accept this. And actually yesterday I was going through contact sheets of the riots at that time in 1978, when there were riots up and down the country. And, people would go out to stop the NF holding meetings in their neighbourhoods and inciting violence aimed at their neighbours. You know, then there was Southall, where somebody who I knew vaguely got killed by the police. He went out to oppose the fascists holding a meeting in Southall Town Hall and died at the end of the day. It was a really scary time. But, you know, we need to take notice of this, because the language that is being used today is the same.
Yeah. And also, I think the different that idea between, like, we seem to be so passive now in terms of everything that's happening in the world, like coming at us with, you know, the cost of living crisis, the fuel, like, and we feel like we're powerless and we're not doing anything. Whereas that's not that long ago where people felt that they could march, they could stand up for things they believed in. We just seem to kind of sit back and take everything these days, to me.
And they did. And that's sort of where I came from. Because as I was starting to take pictures on the sounds, I was learning very, very basic photography at Socialist Worker. That's kind of where I come from. And I photographed a lot of demos and riots and picket lines. You couldn't, honestly, I mean, you couldn't go down the street without coming across a picket line or a demo marching in one direction or another in the late 70s. And there was an attitude of, you know, and there was anti-apartheid, a lot of it is stuff, which you just think, oh, still got that, you know, nothing's much changed. But people have forgotten how to be angry, and that basically these people are put in power by us. And if we don't like what they're doing, we have the power to change that.
There's a fabulous book. Daniel Rachel has been on the podcast. I'm not sure if you're aware of Daniel. Your face is probably in the book, The Walls Come Tumbling Down book.
I
told my mum about the Eric Clapton thing, because she's an Eric Clapton fan, and she put all his albums in the bin, which I thought was a lovely result.
But your mum or Daniel Rachel's mum?
No, my mum. She literally went and got all her CDs, all her albums, and she put them all in the bin.
I love your mum.
She was disgusted, absolutely disgusted.
Yeah.
This has been so lovely having you on the podcast. Thank you so much for joining me. My goodness me, what an amazing career. What a bunch of brilliant stories. I have two final questions for you before you go, though, all right? You are allowed one Paul Weller song for the rest of your life. It can be The Jam, The Style Council, or Solo. What are you going to go with?
Oh, could you not have given me this as my homework?
We didn't talk too much about the music, actually. It's in the songs that really connected with you from The Jam. What were they?
I mean, I loved them all. I loved singing them all so much. I guess Tube Station would be like, it's got to be up there. And then, you know, like English Rose, you know, love songs. You know, that's hard to beat that as a love song, isn't it?
Yeah, so. Absolutely. I'll let you have those entries. If you were to pick one, would it be Tube Station?
Well, you've got
Malice, you've got That's Entertainment. I mean, God, the list goes on.
I know. And they're all so good to sing along to. So, yeah.
Okay, final question. So the purpose of this podcast is to meet lovely people like yourself and hear your stories about your career, your connections with Mr. Weller. But my big regret, I gave up my radio career 10 years ago with one big regret, which is I never got to interview Paul Weller. That's basically the reason why I created this podcast, so we can get that interview, fingers crossed, in 2023. Come on, Paul, if you're listening. If it happens.
Come on, Paul. Come on.
I mean, how much work does a man need to do? Yeah, you got back in the day, just used to rock up and you get an interview for a fanzine, for Christ's sake, you know.
That is exactly how it used to work, Dan. I was doing some stuff yesterday. I was saying to my partner, oh my God, I just walked into the Ritz. I was doing a feature on how the rich spend their summer. I walked into the Ritz and I just took photos of people. I went into hospitals and took pictures of patients and children in schools. You know, nobody said, oh no, no, it's safety or privacy or anything.
It was that easy.
Have you tried that? Have you tried just rocking up outside his door or
with a tape recorder? Yeah, I thought of that. That's maybe a new approach. We'll see how we get on. Now, if it happens, what should I ask him? What would you like to know?
Oh, that's such a kind question. Does he remember all his children's birthdays? Because I struggle with that. He's got loads more than me.
He's got eight. How many have you got?
Well, he's got eight. I've got three, and it's the grandchildren. I really struggle with the grandchildren's birthdays. So good luck with that, Paul.
Any tips? How do you manage it?
I've got it written down in front of me. too many times I've said, oh, happy birthday for being six when they're actually seven or something. I've got it wrong so many times that I now have it written down. And every year I write the date of the age.
Oh, brilliant. And the fact it's right in front of you, through osmosis, it eventually kind of sinks in as well, right?
You'd hope so, but I doubt it.
Oh, dear. Hey, look, this has been so lovely having you on. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank Seriously, Dan, it's really kind of you to ask me, and thank you so much.
My thanks once again to Virginia Turbutt for joining me on the podcast. Amazing stories, fascinating stuff. What a guest. So head to my website for the show notes to this podcast episode, including links to some of the photos that we talked about as well. It's paulwellerfanpodcast.com. Now, whilst you're there, you can show your support by heading to my store. We have exclusive merchandise available for you, including our very first official podcast mug, and you can buy a virtual coffee as well. On the roll call for doing exactly that this week, hello to Smeg from the 829 Club. Says, great podcast, only 127 more to catch up on. Well done, Smeg. Welcome to the club. Hello to Jen. Hi to Rob Atkins. Says, cheers, Dan. Love the podcast. Such an interesting array of people. I've just got to start budgeting better for the additional vinyl, tickets and downloads you've brought into my life. Yep, I know that feeling, Rob. Thank you to Stephen Cartwright. Cheers for your virtual coffee. Hi to Stu Burns. Hello, Colin. Hello, Jane the Jam Tart with a Heart. Hello to Nick Keane. Hello to Andy Vic 7, who says, good to say hello as Steve's 60th on your way out. Superb listening. Keep the faith. Cheers, Andy. Lovely to meet you too. Hello to Jeff, who says, thanks from one of Paul's longest running supporters in the USA. First contact was the album In the City as a college radio DJ in 1977. Second was experiencing the Jam, getting booed off the stage, opening for Angel and the Gods in Allentown in 1978. Truly crushing. Wow. Thank you for that, Jeff. Unbelievable. Alex McLaughlin says, great episode with Terry Edwards. Yet again, a musician who is just a name on an album cover to me. Turns out to be a top bloke and fascinating guest. And of course, will now lead down a rabbit hole of discovery. Cheers. Thumbs up. Thank you, Alex. I love that. That's the whole point of this podcast, really. Yeah, yeah. And getting the final conversation, the final interview with Mr. Weller, of course. Hello to Roger Clark. Thanks for your virtual coffee. Hi to Phil Baker, who says, Bill's podcast was brilliant. Keep up the great work, Dan. Well, thank you for all your virtual coffees. Much appreciated. Cheers for your support. Head to my website to find out more details. Just click on the store button. And whilst you're there, make sure you follow, you subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, on Apple, on Spotify, on Google and more. You can also find me on social media. Get in touch on Twitter at WellerFanPod or on Instagram and Facebook. Just search for Paul Weller Fan Podcast. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.